Well, hello and welcome to what is a special edition of the Adoption and Fostering podcast. Scott, what have we done?
Special. Yeah, very special. Very special you are for even thinking that we could do this.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
This is what happens when Al has thumbs are bored over a weekend. He thinks up things and thoughts and then messages straight away.
Hey, do you think we could speak to the minister, he said? Yes, they said. So they made it happen. I'll be honest, of all the guests we've had, this is the one I feel slightly peculiar about.
I agree. This is next level.
Well, I was thinking, I'm not sure, when we're recording it literally now, we're going to see him in 10 minutes. if Scott doesn't have a moment and needs to lie down beforehand.
Yeah, I have my aneurysms on backup if we need them.
It's terrible, but I know. Please use them if we need. I think that it's right. For one, I've been in meetings with ministers before, and they're very choreographed.
Yeah.
I've been in them with you. And so it's like the minister gets wheeled in for 10 minutes. He says something. People are allowed to ask him a question. He says nothing or she says nothing.
Yeah. We all clap and then they leave.
Literally. To get an hour or however long we get, 45 minutes. And to have a conversation.
Yeah. I know.
It's something else, isn't it?
And that's the key thing, isn't it? Because we've been sitting here wondering how it'll go. This isn't, we obviously we're not journalists, but certainly we're not Kay Burley or one of the, you know, Sky News lot. We're not going to be doing a journal thing. This is a conversation. And I think now that we've agreed on that, between you and I anyway, the DfE don't know this shit, but now that we've agreed it's a conversation, I think I feel better about it because we've only got 45 minutes. We've got hundreds of questions that we've got. We've got about 50 questions that people have sent in. There is no way we're going to get through them in an hour, sadly. But if we can just get an inkling as to kind of, you know, what the future looks like from him as a minister, then, you know, that's enough for me.
And I think, like, I spend a lot of time on social media, and there's kind of this really binary position of that all Tories are bad, everyone else is good. And it's just not as simple as that. You know, so I want to try and unpick that as well with them a bit and say, look, you know, it's a left-leaning workforce.
Yes.
How do you manage all that? So we're a little bit, I think we are genuinely a little bit apprehensive and a bit nervous because it does feel something unusual that we're doing and got ourselves into another fine mess. I'm really looking forward to it. So shall we just kind of swing into the interview and, we'll see how it goes. And then maybe we can, if we need to, we can contact our lawyers afterwards.
Yeah, well, you know, it might be a good idea to have them on maybe the speed.
It's the last time we got invited to the DfE for buns and fun.
Yeah, so here it is. Will Quince, Minister for Children and Families and MP for Colchester.
Excellent. You've been reading Wikipedia.
Did you know?
Well, hello, Will. Thank you for coming on our podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. We appreciate you're a really busy guy, and there's lots of young, bright young things wheel you in and out of rooms all the time, don't they? And they, so it's been taking a long time to get you here, but we really appreciate you taking your time out. We've got lots of things, lots of questions. We have questions from people, but actually we want to just chat about a few things. Can I start at the beginning, really, which is, I'm aware, I've been coming to the DfE, so Scott as well, for maybe 6-7 years now, on and off in different roles. In the last 5 years, we've had 5 children's ministers. Now, the cynic in me wants to say, this is a training ground for ministers. That if you do well, then they let you on to bigger and brighter things. If you don't, then you're sidled off to the back benches. Convince me that you're in it for the long haul. What makes you different?
It's a really good question, and one really only the Prime Minister can answer, because all ministerial roles are in the gift of the Prime Minister, and you serve in them for as long or as little as the Prime Minister wants you to. I think where you rightly point at a problem, if you like, is that all of the junior ministerial roles, inevitably are roles in which you go in one of two directions. You either perform well and ultimately that will then potentially move on to other roles within government, be it a more senior role like a minister of state or even a secretary of state. Or the other is that you perhaps don't, or for whatever other reason, you return to the back benches. But I think there's a couple of things I would say in response to that is that, firstly, when you take that call from the Prime Minister, you never quite know what you're going to be offered and what role he or she would want you to do. My first job in government 2.5 years ago, or 2.5 years before I was appointed as the Children and Families Minister, was at the Department for Work and Pensions. And I think one of the great things about the Children and Families Brief is that in my previous role at the Department for Work and Pensions, I had huge engagement with the Children and Families Brief. You know, for example, I worked on care leaver policy in the DWP. So I introduced the shared accommodation rate. I did a lot of work on food insecurity and around free school meals. And so a lot of the brief, I'd already worked very closely with my counterpart. And I think one of the beauties of the Children and Families Minister role is that it is a cross-cutting government role, because your role is to advocate for children and families across government. And I think it's one of those roles that regardless of whether you're in it for 6 months or 6 years, it gets under your skin for a couple of reasons. One, because you never forget that this is largely about some of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged children in our country. And two, because you know that every area of government can play a part in improving the life chances of these children. So I would like to think, and I've been in this role for just coming up to 10 months, that whether I'm in this role for another month or another 10 years, that everything I've learned about the importance of, you know, our corporate parenting responsibility and our responsibility to do all we possibly can to improve the life chances of some of the most vulnerable disadvantaged children in our country, I'll take with me, regardless of whether I'm still continue as a minister here, elsewhere, or indeed, you know, as a backbencher. But where I agree with you, I think there is, of course, benefit to having some longevity in role. So where you kick something off, you follow it through.
I mean, Edward Timpson, sort of, I know that he lobbied to remain in the role to kind of see through some sort of things that he'd put in. But do you understand that as a parent, you know, there's some children's ministers who came and went, and I don't even know their names.
Yeah,
you know, I literally... And that's frustrating, because you are effectively, you know, we often talk around of people being the corporate parent, you know, like the local authority is the corporate parent, but ultimately that washes up at your door. You are the parent of all of these vulnerable children whose parents, for whatever reason, can't or won't, or, you know, it's you. So to see it as just a poor, like a brief that you're given for a year or two or three or maybe longer, that doesn't necessarily inspire confidence in, you know, in the population.
No, I get it. And I think it's the nature of government. But I think one thing that I hope will give you some reassurance is that I still regularly speak, in fact, in the case of Ed Timpson, on a weekly basis about issues within this portfolio. I run with Ed on a morning most weeks. So we chat through some of these issues. I still also speak regularly with Tim Lawton, former Children's Minister, and likewise, I think, you know, it's really interesting when Nadeem Zahawi was made Secretary of State, appointed Secretary of State at the same point as I was made Children's and Families Minister. Of course, he was a former Children's and Families Minister. And so when he came back in the department, one of the first things he said as he walked in the door is that he said, we are going to change the game for looked after children in this country. And so I think there is something about having had experience in this brief, however long you have it for, that is something you take with you. And I don't think you're ever going to forget. And to be frank with you, even things like reading the serious incident notification report on a weekly basis and seeing some of the horrific things that happen to children across our country, that never leaves you. And I think you will always strive to do everything you possibly can to change the system for the better.
Hmm. I don't know whether you want to add, ask any questions, Scott, because I've got my head's fizzing.
I know that this is how it rolls. You see, I just sit here until he asks me if I want to ask something, because I don't like to butt in on guests. You see, that's the thing about our fans. I guess, from my perspective, I think that's a really good thing to hear, that you are kind of connected with these people. Because I think when you don't understand how something works, you just imagine that you go into your office all day and you're surrounded by people who inform and what have you. But to hear that actually you speak to people who've done this role in the past is really, I personally think is quite reassuring, especially, you know, yeah. ones that have done good things in those roles. I guess my question then would be about kind of understanding. I mean, we know that obviously in your personal life, you're a husband and a father. What kind of understanding have you been able to kind of gather in terms of, you know, the children that we're talking about and how they live? And I'm talking about really fostering and adoption here. I'm not, you know, long-term care and stuff is obviously really interesting to us as well, but our podcast is adoption and fostering. So what kind of things have you done to kind of inform yourself
yeah.
in terms of how, you know, how families
do? It's a great question because we all have our own lived experience, and it's of course very, very different to others. And I have friends who have been fostered. I have friends who have been adopted. I've got friends who have who are adopted parents. And so you hear a bit, but actually the key, and I was determined to do this from day one, is to get out every single week in this role and meet with children, young people, and parents and carers, and adoptive families, and fosterers, and social workers, to really get a better understanding of what it's really like. Because you know, you set policy intent in here in Whitehall, but actually what happens on the ground is really important. And I suppose coming. You sort of touch on my own personal experience, and you're right. I'm a dad. I've got two young girls. I've got a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old. And you know, as a parent, you know, my whole role, if you like, my whole existence is to provide a stable, loving home for those two girls that is full of love and laughter, and to give them every single opportunity to have a better life chance than I had and my parents had. That I think that's instinctively what every parent wants for their children. And for every single child that doesn't have that, that is in the care system, that is waiting too long for that stable, loving home, that pains me. It hurts me because I think about the opportunities I'm giving to my two girls. And even then I'm constantly striving to think, how can I give them more? How can I better champion and advocate for them? And the idea that there are children and young people who often have had some really traumatic starts in life that still don't have that champion, that advocate, those people who are going to fight for them and give them that loving, stable, permanent home full of love and laughter, that really gets me. And I think it probably gets everyone who does this role, and it makes you want to strive to do everything we possibly can. Because I might be naive in this, but I genuinely take the approach that there are parents out there for every child that needs them. And I know that because I've got friends who desperately wanted to be parents and couldn't, or friends who, you know, have been parents but still have you know space in their lives to give care and love for more. It's about making that connection and giving people the support and making it as attractive as possible and as easy and as accessible as possible. And that's what drives me.
You've spoken really articulately about that. And actually, it's really nice to hear a politician speak, because you're a politician. So this is a slightly political question. And I was thinking about this. I was pondering the conversation to have with you. And it is a political question, I'm not going to draw you onto the rocks of all the other stuff, And is it an issue or a challenge in that you are the workforce who, you know, work with children? It's a generalization, but are predominantly left-leaning, aren't they? That's my experience. But there's a PR issue, because I see often that the Tories, conservatives are seen as uncaring. There's that stereotype, and you know, I don't think it's necessarily fair, but that's how it's perceived in the media and on social media. And yet here you are speaking passionately and articulately about caring for children. But how do you battle that? How do you combat that?
Well, I think on social media in particular, you've got to have a pretty thick skin. And you know, I take the view in politics. Look, some of my best friends in Parliament are Labour MPs, and not that they'd be very happy with me sharing that publicly. I think in part our politics in part driven by social media, in part driven by broader media, has become really ideological and tribal. And we've forgot some fundamentals. And those fundamentals are that ultimately we all want the same thing. We just have different ideas about the journey or the path to get there. I think it's therefore really unhelpful to paint a particular party or group or ideology as being uncaring, or nobody has a monopoly on wanting to do the best we possibly can for the most vulnerable and disadvantaged children. We just have different ideas about how to get there and how to do it whilst being you know, fiscally prudent and responsible and doing things in the right way. And you know, naturally, any politician, any government makes mistakes. The question is how you learn from that, and how, with the hands you've been dealt, and with the financial position at the time, and you know, how much legislative time you have, and other things, how much you can influence in your time in office. So it is tricky, and I think it's a generalization that, as you rightly say, is unfair. And you know, when I visit charities and voluntary organizations up and down the country, working with care leavers, but also more broadly on other aspects of society, people will often whisper, and they'll say, "Oh, yeah, we're conservatives," and you say, "Well, you don't have to whisper it. It's okay." I think some people are shy in saying it because they're worried because others may take a different political view or stance to them, that somehow it's not okay. And it has become a bit binary, that you're right or you're wrong, and you're Tory or you're Labour, and there's no room for some middle ground. But actually, when I look at some of my sort of Labour parliamentary colleagues on many issues, there's wafer thin between us on sort of policy and views. I think if we could all just sort of recognize that we all broadly want the same thing, we just have ever so slightly different views on how to get there, I think we'd be in a better place. But I think I'm optimistic and a little naive in thinking that's going to happen anytime soon.
You give really long answers. Your media training said, soak up the interview time. So, you know, come on, make it snap. We will have some yes and no questions later on. So, you know, prepare yourself mentally for that.
Well, I would agree with the thick skin thing. I think social media is a great invention, but probably the worst invention ever. I wanted to ask you about the care review, so start from the beginning. You've obviously taken it on within your role. So what are your thoughts about it, how it's gone, and the kind of results of that? Is there any? We spoke to Josh last week. You know, we asked him the same question. Was there any surprises? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And, you know, I've been in the role coming up to 10 months, and I got out quite early on and was meeting with care leavers. I'd met many before in my previous role, but got out into children's homes, met with social workers. I've spent some time shadowing a social worker. And my first meeting with Josh, I said to him, because I'd obviously seen the case for change, where he very comprehensively set out some of the, because there are many issues with the current system, many of which are decades old, and said, "Josh, we've really got to press reset on this and properly shake up this system." And he totally agrees, and we were very much on the same page. And you know, I'm full of admiration for Josh, and I think he and his team have done the most incredibly comprehensive report, which is in the best part of 300 pages. He's spoken with thousands of people with lived experience and who really understand the system and what needs to change. So I'm really excited about what he's put forward. Do I agree with every single one of his recommendations? No, but the majority, yes. Do I see merit in most of them? Yes. Do I want to ensure that we stress test those ideas and just make sure that we're on the right path? Yes. And then the key is now setting up a national implementation board and then a full implementation plan by the end of this year to start bringing about the change that we all want to see. So there's been some initial changes, some ideas I've come, we can do straight away, and then others we're going to have to give a bit more thought to, in part because of the sort of financial cost, and others because we're going to need to change the law.
Can you make sense of what a national implementation board looks like? Because that could be seen as just, you know, you get your mates together and we decide what's going to happen. Or is it going to be across the spectrum of social care and
yeah. So
who's going to be on it? And yeah. Who gets
so I'm still working that up at the moment, but a guarantee I can give. So Josh will certainly be on it. Ofsted will be on it. So and I will have. I've asked the charities, the big charities in this space, to recommend and nominate individuals with lived experience of the care system, because it's important that we have their voice strongly represented on the board too. But equally important, because I'm really, really, really keen to make sure that we motor on with implementation, that we have experience of people who have that, or the experience of people with bringing about large transformational change in complex systems, because that's going to be our biggest challenge now. We've got the ideas, we've got the plan, we've got the direction of travel. How do we implement and embed this across the system, which is huge? And some of it's legislation, some of it's process and procedure, but some of it is cultural. And that's some of the hardest elements to change. So I'll be announcing soon. I've just got to work through some detail, the full board, and then we'll have an implementation plan announced by the end of this year.
Because Scott's free on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You've got to get in quick because his diary fills up.
Well, I was just going to say about that. I mean, I guess like everything that we've been, thinking about the last 7 years, being involved in lots of different things. Whilst it's great to have these big charities on board, of course, you know, not forgetting the independent people who may not be members of those charities, they may not have connections with those charities. So whilst, you know, totally get where you're going with that, I think, you know, maybe, sorry, I'm trying to influence here, but, you know, just think about the people who may not be connected to these charities that may want to get on there. So now you're answering the questions faster. We're getting into them faster, which is great. So one of the things that came up in the care review was the care leaver as a protected characteristic. Is that something that you think is right? Do you want to see it happen, or is it one of the ones that you're maybe not so sure about?
It's a great question, and I completely understand the merit in asking the question. And I'm hugely sympathetic to the idea. I want to stress test it, because I'm conscious that it comes with consequences, both unintended and intended. And one of the things that I saw when I was a minister at the Department for Work and Pensions for 2.5 years before being appointed as Minister for Children and Families, is we had a number of easements and put in place specifically for care leavers. But there was a real reluctance of care leavers to self-identify or come forward as a care leaver. So my only reservation is whether it would put people off identifying as a care leaver or having lived care experience. And because my worry would be that they would then miss out on support that we put in place. So, for example, you know, when I was at the DWP, I brought in changes to the shared accommodation rate for young care leavers. The idea that a young person would miss out on that because they didn't want to identify or disclose the fact they're a care leaver concerns me. So I'm not in principle against the idea. I just want to stress test it and make sure that the unintended consequences don't mean we're actually disadvantaging care leavers, which would undermine the intention of the recommendation.
And I guess some of that is to do with stigma.
It is. That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. And we need to do more. And I was constantly pushing officials to do more around, before you ask the question, if someone has care experience, tell them why. Tell them why it's relevant. And it's not relevant. It's not relevant in that we're going to single you out or identify you for no purpose. It's because we want to offer additional support, recognizing your experience. And so it's really important that you make clear why you're asking the question.
Excellent. I have another couple of yes or no questions.
These yes or no questions? God,
yes or no. Yes or no. We're meant to be very sensible because we've got an important person with us. Yeah. So thinking about, there's been a couple of recent campaigns. One was specifically about, because we are adoption and fostering, so that's where, you know, that's our main listenership. The self-employed people's adoption allowance, is that something that is going to change, or are you going to tell me that it's just really complicated and it's not in your gift?
So yes, it's really complicated. Yes, it's not in my gift, but it doesn't mean I'm not looking at it, because it is, if it matters to adoptive families, and prospective adoptive families, then of course it matters to me, because I want to see more people coming forward as adopters, especially if it means that we have more choice in terms of potential placements across the country. So it's something I'm looking at very closely. I've already raised it with Paul Scully, who's a minister at Bays, which is where this area sits. I understand why we are where we are around self-employed. And I know there's been the Taylor Review and other aspects, and it's a broader issue around entitlements for those who are self-employed versus those who are PAYE. I get it. But at the same time, I want to do everything I possibly can to break down any barrier that exists to people coming forward and adopting. So not in my gift, very complicated, but I'm on it and I'm exploring it.
That was a great politician's answer. You've done well at your training, haven't you? I mean, I appreciate that it's complicated, isn't it? And I think that we're so often, I was thinking about talking to you and I was thinking, we're so used to listening to like the Today program or Panorama, where we're trying to get gotcha moments. We're trying to get like firm answers out of people. It just feels really frustrating as a listener going, well, it's obvious. We should just do it. It's not a lot of money. We spend this much on recruitment. Just skim a little bit off the top, whack it over to these people. Is it that simple?
Oh, well, I wish it was. And, you know, it's very often there is a very simple, easy answer to every question, but usually it's not the right one.
Fair enough. Scott?
So my next question is about the Adoption Support Fund, really. And obviously we've got another extension on it, should we say. Two questions within this. One is about the name of it. That's something that we've been whacking on about for ages as well. Obviously, it started off as the Adoption Support Fund. It's now been extended out to the special guardians and other group, should we say. So what are the chances of a name change on this? I mean, is it something that's under your in your portfolio?
It very much is. And I was delighted to be able to be in a position to announce the extension for 3 years of 144 million quid, because having met and spoken with parents and children and young people, I know what a difference it's making. And the Secretary of State, again, shares my view on this as a former Children and Families Minister himself. So I'm all ears. So I mean, what's your view on what you would like it to be called?
Well, we've put the Therapeutic Support Fund because that's what we think.
Yeah, and that probably does pretty much describe what it is and largely what it's being used for. So
yeah, I think
I'm going to write that down.
Too. We'll email you. what's interesting, both Al and I, well, Al was involved before I got involved, but I was involved in the rollout when I worked for Adoption UK. And it was very, you know, there's been a lot of kind of to and fro in terms of what it covers, what it doesn't, what, you know, this and the next thing. But I guess the main issue that we hear day in, day out, whether it's as adoptive parents ourselves or through the podcast or the work that we do, is that, you know, there's going to be children beyond 2025 that need this support as well. So, and I know that, you know, obviously it depends on governments and policymakers that are in, you know, voted in effectively at that time. But is there a way of making this, you know, something that's kind of a priority for governments going forward? Because, you know, the one thing that we hear all the time is and this is from therapeutic providers as well, they can't plan ahead. You know, they can't make sure they've got enough therapists and counsellors and stuff like that. So is it something that, you know, is there for the future, or is it just till 2025?
So personally, would I like to see it there for the future? Yes, of course I would, because I see the not just the benefit, but I see the huge value in it as well too. Not just the value to those parents and children and young people, but the value to broader society. And I think it represents very, very good value for money. The challenge is that, you know, instinctively, it comes back to the earlier question, you know, of course it makes sense to extend it further, but we work in government financial cycles, which means you work in spending review periods. And at the moment we're in a 3-year spending review period. So the great news was I was allowed to announce 3 years worth of funding. But because the government hasn't set budgets post 2025, I'm unable to confirm what happens post 2025. And I'm pleased we had a 3-year SR period, because ahead of that, they were single year settlements and it was announced year on year. And I know how hard that is for local authorities and regional adoption agencies and others to be really innovative with that funding and to give certainty and consistency and clarity. I'd love to be able to do it. I think, of course, it would make sense to be able to set it for 10, 15, 20 years and just say to you that, yeah, this is really, really important to us, so we're going to do it. Instinctively, I think it will continue, but I can't guarantee it because we just don't know what the budget will be for 2025 onwards.
Yeah.
My concern is that we end up in a position where we're constantly having to go with our begging bowl. Is there not a way that we can actually just hardwire that funding into services so that actually it becomes that RAAs are providing it and they're not having to, like Scott described, this kind of, you get to within 6 months and everyone starts to wobble at the amount of chatter about people really anxious. Was that not the original intention, that we move to a position where adoption support is just better?
Well, we certainly want that. But I think in any area of government, you have to work within the financial cycles. And it's, of course, it's helpful when you have longer periods, like a 3-year SR period. Unfortunately, it's just the way government finance works. And I would love to be able to give you an answer, because, you know, to say we could do it longer, that there just isn't a way of doing that within the way governments set their budgets for certain periods of time.
And I think people don't necessarily understand that. And I was speaking to one of your colleagues, and we've had this conversation over and over again. And people, I'm doing your job for you now, is that every aspect of government spending is subject to review, isn't it? But we don't, you know, we never would look at education and go, hope they fund the schools next year.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So spending review periods, and up until this year, they've been 1-year settlements, and this is now a 3-year settlement. And there is actually good reason to say that for why as well, because actually in 2025, if the, you know, financial position of the country is considerably greater, then it won't shock you to know I'll be going to the Treasury with a greater ask for the adoption support fund and say, look, we could go further and faster. I'll have some more funding, please.
So that's a confirmation that you're going to stay in the job for 4 years. So you're lobbying Boris Johnson
you might have to put that one to the Prime Minister.
I mean, you can lobby for that, can't you? You can say, I'm not moving, and chain yourself to Edward Timpson's old desk.
as you can tell, we did enjoy the time with Ed Timpson. So
he's a very, very good friend. I was with him only yesterday at a couple of events around adoption and care leavers. He's a good friend of mine, and he did a fantastic job. He really did. And I use him as a point of great wisdom when I have questions that I don't necessarily want to ask the civil servants about.
Well, I think that the lesson, I would take from him is that he was able to communicate that this was something he was genuinely interested in, whereas perhaps some of your predecessors have struggled to do that. And that's not to say they weren't, but to have that assurance, I think people say, well, yeah, Edward Timpson, he must, as much as he was a Tory, he seemed really bothered. And that, you know, so you need to get your PR people, you're going to have a strict word with them, knock the lattes out of their hands and say, hey, do a better job. Anyway, we're into the nonsense now. Sorry, this is how we roll. Yeah, we've got some time left. Can I ask a question? This is kind of this is an issue that is slightly murky for you in your role, is in relation to adult adopted people. So I think what we've seen, Scott and I, and you know, my children have turned into adults. Who knew that would happen? And so the issues around being an adult adoptee have become much more on my radar. My children are now 28, 25, 24, 18, 17, 10. And the issues around being a young adopted adult and an older adopted adult, that status doesn't remain. Adoption isn't an event in time. It's something that continues to, it's like an onion, unpeel layers and layers. We're in a situation where at the moment, if you as an adult adopted person, you want to go and seek therapy and support in relation to your experience of being adoption, unless that person is Ofsted registered, you can't. Now, I understand I understand why that's there, because it makes you want to get good support. But in effect, does that mean that we're prohibiting people from getting support because in a whole host of reasons? Is there any sort of thoughts? Is there any discussion going on in relation to how we support adult adopted people?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and in truth, it's not one I have given. I think in the context of the CARE review and the SEN review and all other issues that are currently live at the moment, probably enough thought. So there aren't any plans to change regulations for adoption agencies to support adoptees through adulthood at the moment. But I think I certainly recognise what you say in terms of the things like therapeutic support and mental health support. It doesn't just turn off when you reach 18. So it's I'd be really interested in your thoughts on it actually, and perhaps want to take offline and sort of discuss sort of a greater length another day. But I mean, I inevitably work really closely with my counterpart at the Department for Health and Social Care, Gillian Keegan, around mental health, and I know this something like £2.3 billion more being put into the mental health under the long-term plan for the NHS. But I'm also aware that we do need to provide more support, and I'm happy to explore it. I think I can understand where you're coming from, and that we need to do more. It's just I haven't given it sufficient support today.
I can't corner you about an issue that you don't feel, I can't sort of get a commitment to you from to change that, because obviously there's a legislative change around that, and that stuff doesn't happen very easily. I don't know whether Scott, you, because you've got young adults as well, and it's you've got your finger on the pulse.
And I was just going to say as well, and it's not necessarily that it's a long-term support thing either. It could be one-off things. My older sons are 24 and 23, and it's not necessarily, something that's going to be ongoing. It could be just one-offs, in terms of some of the stuff that they experience all the time. So, I think that, again, social media, you read experiences, you read, from people who are really affected by the adoption process and their kind of upbringings and childhoods. And I just, it's definitely something that we would welcome the opportunity to discuss further, because I think we're still in this kind of 1960s, 70s view that once you reach adulthood, you can come to terms with things, and you can do things off your own bat. But it's not necessarily the same. And it's what I think it's one of the very few myths now that still exist about adoption, is that adults can still be affected by it. And even we speak to a lot of adults who've been adopted who are now in their 60s, 50s, and they could still they could do with access and support even now. So, it's not just people who are 24, 25, 26. It's ongoing. So I think that it does need to be something that we kind of put on an agenda somewhere, shall we say?
I think we'd be more than happy to give you some names of people who would probably be able to articulate it from a personal experience, but also we know professional friend. We've got people through our work we do, professionals, people who are social workers but were adopted, would be able to give you a really kind of system as well as personal insight to that.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Excellent. So there's another commitment. Excellent.
You didn't write that one down so well. Just saying.
Sorry, this is like herding sheep, getting you and me to have a sensible
Let me go on to my next question then, really.
Oh, go on then,
It's about, there's a recent call, I can't remember his name, but there's a kind of recent call for children entering care or who've experienced care to have to automatically get an education healthcare plan assessment. What are your thoughts on that? If you've heard of it, certainly something that, we've thought about and spoke about a little bit over the years. Have you ever thought about that so far? Or?
So I haven't given that much thought, and I don't think that anybody that I've met so far has presented that as or given me a sort of evidence-based approach as to why that would be a sensible thing to do. I can certainly anecdotally understand why, having spoken with some children and young people entering care, especially given the number of young people, and I say teenagers entering care now, why that would be something that would be something we should consider. So I'm happy to take it away and look at it. And if you've got people who are particularly expertise in that, have particular expertise in that field or experience and are sort of strong advocates for that, of course I'd be very happy to look at it.
I think there's a petition that's gone into the parliamentary website by a man called Robert Leach, Leach.
That's okay.
Robert Leach, and he's a headmaster and an adoptive parent. And I think it's it's the education healthcare plan, and often I think it's the carer element that's often sometimes the hard one to quantify in relation to the additional needs of children. I've got like three questions in my head. Can I go back a step and talk about adult adoptees? And because obviously there's recently been the Joint Committee on Human Rights and the Inquiry into the Right to Family Life, which has been holding evidence over the last, since September, I think, last year. We've had guests on who've adopted people who've argued, yes, there should be an apology. No, there should be an apology. We've had different views. What do you have any specific views in relation to whether there should be an apology in relation to historic sort of adoption practice?
I do. I'm just going to come back to your previous question because I've just recalled actually a few months ago, I did meet, I'm not sure if it was with Robert, but it was with somebody else who from a specific mental health perspective was talking about EHCPs and making that case. So I think that work may be underway looking into that specific point, but I think less from a special educational needs or disabilities perspective, but from a mental health and access to support perspective. On the sort of historical adoption practices, I know the Secretary of State has spoken about this, and I've got huge sympathy for those who have been affected by historical adoption practices, and your heart can't not go out for all of the parents and children of those who have been involved. These practices were clearly wrong, and yes, they took place in a time when society shared some very different views and values, things which we would find alien and unacceptable today. And I'm trying to remember when the Secretary of State made his comments, but I think it was at the recent Joint Committee on Human Rights and the hearing there. And I think he articulated how sorry he was for what parents and children had gone through. And I completely support that statement. And I think we're awaiting the JCHR's report on that inquiry. And I have no doubt that the Secretary of State and the I will consider those recommendations very carefully.
Cool. Scott and I are arguing over the next question, which takes us back to school. And this is a specific question that came up because we sort of said to people when we've spent some time getting this interview arranged. So it was the first time that it was going to happen, and we asked people, you know, any questions you'd like us to ask? Stupid thing to do, wasn't it? In no way did that cause a bit of smoke coming out the back of my computer. But one of the questions that I thought was really, really interesting was in relation to the government's behaviour czar, Tom Bennett. And I think that he's seen amongst the community that we come from, which is fostered adoption, special guardianship, children with special educational needs, I think it's 55% of children who are looked after have SEN as opposed to 14% of the general population. So there's much higher prevalence. Saying, you know, the question directly was, do you agree with Tom Bennett's approach to supporting vulnerable children or children who have experienced trauma?
Wow. You're sort of ending on some toughies. I don't have a direct responsibility for behaviour in schools, and that more broadly sits with the schools minister, but inevitably I have crossover, because as you rightly point out, that often behavior or challenging behavior in the classroom is driven by an underlying and often undermet special educational need. That's something I'm acutely aware of. And that's why the SEN review, which we also launched in March, is the SEN an alternative provision review, because AP is a really key part of that. And I suppose there's a sort of fundamental tenet that good behaviour in schools is central to a good education, and schools have to manage it and provide calm, safe and supportive environments where all children can learn and thrive. At the same time, we've got to better understand why children are exhibiting challenging behaviour. And in many cases, it's a cry for help and support. So as part of the review, we're looking at some of the changes we need to make around more alternative provision providers coming into schools and assisting. Better training for teachers around initial teacher training and SENCO training with the National Professional Qualification to early identify support that people may need. And then the key is that if you're excluded from education, excluded from school, it should never ever be excluded from education. And you know, if you are in alternative religion, the aim is to get you back into mainstream as long as it's appropriate as quickly as possible. But when it comes to children within the care system or with care experience, the key role is going to be that of the virtual school head and ensuring that there is no exclusion or penalty for poor behavior without consultation with the virtual school's head to make sure that support is put in place first. So I think it's the right approach to have a strong emphasis on good behavior and a good education. But we've got to make sure that we recognize and tailor any response to the individual needs of the child or young person, because often it's a cry for help or it's a sign that they need more support, not that they just need moving to alternative provision.
Yeah. I mean, on the back of that, I'll give you a quote from a parent who spoke to me about an academy admission policy that said, this is quotation, we won't take a child with an EHCP plan unless they're an existing pupil who was then allocated one. And so there's some schools who just won't countenance it. I mean, academies, I don't want to draw you into the academies.
So that's illegal. Schools aren't able to do that. And to be frank, it's discrimination. They shouldn't be doing that. And one of the things we're consulting on is, at the moment, only the Secretary of State can mandate or direct a school to take a child. We're consulting on giving that power to local authorities. And we all know it happens, but it shouldn't happen. And actually, at the heart of getting special educational needs right, it is about ensuring that all schools take an inclusive approach. And I'm looking at a number of things. Like Ofsted at the moment will go into a school as part of an inspection, and they will understandably look at how schools are catering for and supporting children with special educational needs and disabilities within their school. But they should also be going in and asking, where are your children with SEND in this school? Why doesn't this school reflect the community that you serve? So I think there are a number of steps and measures that we're taking to address this issue that you rightly identify.
Mm.
Thank you.
And in terms of then pupil premium plus post 16, I mean, you know, that's an issue as well. Is there, you know, it's like the ASF question, I guess. You know, there's obviously funding implications with this, but you know, children and young people do stay in school after 16, and my experience would be that there was very little support for my young person, and he ended up leaving within the 6 months that he started, if you know what I mean. So what you know, this is something that's been talked about for a while. Is it something that's again on your radar? Or?
So I think what one of the great things about the care review more broadly is we're not just looking at, and I think in the past, certainly the past few years, arguably over the past best part of a decade, we've had lots of piecemeal reform. But for the first time, Josh McAllister, the review, has looked at the whole system. And that's why it's a best part of 300 pages. He's spoken with thousands of people, and there are something like 80 recommendations in there. So I think we're at a place where almost everything's back on the table, and we're looking at everything in the round. So I can't give you a sort of specific commitment on that, but I think we are more broadly looking at how best we can support children and young people with not just care experience, but also as they leave care too, and what further support they might need, sort of as they sort of transition into sort of adulthood and independent living.
We're getting into the long grass now, because we've got the listeners' questions.
Yeah, we've got more than what we'll have time to read out. So you can breathe a sigh of relief, really.
Yeah, we filtered some of them as well, because some of them are not necessarily there. Then you know it's not the right question. But one that I thought was really interesting was, why can't we have a national recruitment campaign in relation to fostering, akin to what we have with adoption? We've got the You Can Adopt. Do you think there's room or a place for a You Can Foster campaign?
So watch this space, I would say. I think one of the sort of key recommendations of the review, and one that there are only so many things you can do immediately and just crack on with straight away. And I think something that would be game changing is getting more people come forward, but also supported through the process to become foster parents. So it's something I'm really passionate about, and just watch this space over the coming weeks and months.
Oh, that was exciting, wasn't it? Yeah, I'll get us listeners. Scott, have you...
I'm scrolling through and there's so many questions that we've got and so many screenshots, and I honestly can't decide which one to ask you. And also the other thing with some of these questions was there's stuff that we wanted to ask as well. So you go to one and then I'll find one.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally, are you optimistic? I mean, it's a big question, and I'm conscious that you're a politician, so you've got to be careful. You always be careful what you say, because it can come back to you, can't it? You know, like someone will come and have a tap on your shoulder and go, "We heard you said something on a podcast that you shouldn't have," and you know, there'll be a serious dressing down by some whip somewhere. But when you think about the care of you, what would be the things that you would like to see implemented? Because you talked about, it's easy to talk in vague terms about, oh, there's something. Specifically, what would you like to see happen?
Wow. Okay. Well, I think fundamentally there are so many different aspects of the review that I think we're gonna need to give serious thought. Let's say there are things that you can do straight away, and especially around safeguarding and around fostering and the framework for social workers. But I think there are longer term elements that are really attractive to me, like for example early help, like for example the things that really excite me around things like how we can turbocharge kinship care and special guardians, and make sure through the family courts proceedings that those family conferences are being held at a much earlier stage. So options for children to stay within families are identified much earlier, and not just at the point just before a child's taken into care. But there are over sort of 80 recommendations. I think the vast majority of which have merit. There are some in there which are controversial, like the IRO's proposal, for example, which I was hearing from young people to say they don't particularly agree with. So that's why I didn't agree with all the recommendations straight away and say, right, yep, we're going to implement all of this, and this is the time frame in which we're going to do it, because we need to test some of the assumptions that Josh and his team have set out, and importantly, listen to those with lived experience to make sure that what we're proposing is actually the right thing to do.
I mean, that felt like a really honest answer, because I could see that at the beginning it was like you were trying to think about what you can say and what you want to say.
Well, a little bit, because I mean, there are sort of like multiple facets and aspects to the review, and you know, on one side there's the whole child safeguarding piece, and if there's an area that keeps me up at night, it's that. And you know, so when you're reading the Serious Incident Report, it's harrowing reading, and you know, we've had recently the National Panel review into Arthur and Star's death. You know, these are horrific tragedies that we've just got to do all we possibly can to prevent. And then you've got what pains me as well when I meet with care leavers and they tell me about this sort of horrific experience they've had at 16, 17, and then 18, and having to furnish their own accommodation and moving into accommodation that doesn't have carpets and not having anyone that's advocating and supporting them. And that preys on my mind hugely as well. And so there's so much to do. And I think the great thing about the review is it gives us a roadmap to deliver the change that we all want to see. Some of it we can do straight away. Some of it's going to take legislation, which means it's going to take a little bit of time. And others, I mean, it does come with a hefty price tag in the billions, the BNs, which means that I've got to make a really compelling evidence-based value for money case to Treasury around how this is actually going to not just transform the lives of children and young people, and particularly the most vulnerable, but it's actually going to save the taxpayer money too. And I think we can do that. And Josh has gone a long way to helping us in that aim with some fantastic modelling, but we've got to do our own work to really get under the skin of that, stress test it, work on how deliverable it is, and then put a plan in place to make it happen.
Do you enjoy your job?
I do. It's not without its challenges, because there are the most wonderful aspects of it. You know, like the changes that we're making around early years, you know, knowing the importance of those sort of 0 to 5. I mean, I've got two young children myself. Spending time with children I can see why people do it as a career, because they are full of life and energy, and you desperately want to do all you possibly can to give them every possible chance to fulfill their potential. But I'm not going to pretend that seeing some of the and reading and hearing about some of the things that parents, and it usually as parents or wider family members, are able to do and do to their children, shocks me to my core. And I suppose the day it doesn't shock me is the day I should walk away from this job and not do it anymore. And so that's the negative bit, if you like. But having said that, every week when I read it, it spurs and drives me on to try and do all we possibly can to improve the system. And whilst I'm acutely aware that there is no review, no process, no procedure, no legislation that can eradicate evil, it's just not possible. What we can do is do everything we possibly can to identify it, to spot it, to report it, and then remove children from those harmful situations as quickly as possible.
Well, that's great. Thank you. Will, thank you so much for your time. I feel like you've been really honest. I think you started as a politician and we got the human out of you. You worked hard, if I'm honest. I could hear the media training, but then you became normal. So well done. I'll give you a strong 7 out of 10. Thank you so much for your time. And I really appreciate the energy that's gone into kind of getting yourself in front of us.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Scott, literally, we've just recorded that. How do you feel?
I wish I had alcohol. I could do with a beer. Not because it was hard, just because, I don't know, once I got into it, it seemed to flow really well. I think that at the beginning he was a proper politician, and by the end of it he was only a half politician. He's got, you know, he can't say yes to this and no to that, and, you know, everything kind of in terms of funding and stuff like that. But I thought he was genuine. The one thing I will say, I'm apolitical. And so left or right, I don't know who's left, who's right, what all that sort of thing. All I know is we just interviewed a man who's responsible for it at the minute. And, you know, he seemed to be interested in some of the points we made. He made some notes. I think he wrote down 3 things. So we'll keep you posted
off
on that.
With his head.
I don't know about you, but I saw it went.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that the thing that probably is quite telling is that link with Edward Timpson.
Do you know, I have to say, when you mentioned that, I was like, oh, okay. And it was interesting because the care leaver, was it the care? What was the thing that was on yesterday? There was something on yesterday, wasn't there, in Westminster?
Yes, there was.
And I saw a photograph that had been posted by PAC UK, and Ed Timpson was there. And it just made sense, because you tend to think that they're just stuck in their offices and they're surrounded by civil servants and what have you, but they wouldn't be involved with previous ministers. And I think that's great, actually. I think that really gives you an insight into how they work.
Yeah.
Is it the same that a prime minister would speak to a previous prime minister? You know, probably, but you don't think like that, do you? No. I don't think that.
No. I mean, I think, like you say, he couldn't give answers, but there was certainly a sense of that he had a really good grasp of the circumstances. Yeah. And I think he's right. You know, there's a lot of the stuff from the care review that you can't just say yes, 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 or no, no, no. You've got to look at it. The thing that I thought was interesting was in relation, it's just gone from my head. In relation to the IROs, that he said, actually, he's heard some kids saying that's not true. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting that he's gone out and he's found out for himself. That
yeah.
I think there's always been this concern over that particular issue. And we should ask Mark Oates, who we're going to speak to in a few weeks, because he highlighted the same issue in his report, the fostering stock take. The issue has always been that it's been a government-driven issue to remove the IROs. And it's interesting that then you've got someone like him going, well, I've heard differently. And you go, so it's not a nefarious plot.
Yeah. And I think, you know, his response to the ASF was interesting as well. You know, as an individual, I think you can accept that, you know, he would love to be able to confirm it forever, but that's just not within his, you know, within his ability, you know. So, yeah, it was a good one. I enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it. I'll be honest, I was very stressed about that.
Yeah, I was as well.
Yeah.
That's to be fair, though, Al, last night we messaged each other and said we didn't think it was going to happen, so we didn't really pay much attention.
So many times it's been changed and chopped and changed. I thought, it'll happen when it happens. And then 10 minutes before I go, what really is going to happen?
Yeah. And then, it got cancelled. But today we actually had to do it.
Excellent. Well, Scott, as always, how was things with you?
Yeah, fine. Let's move on. I need to go. So it's not that I don't love you to bits, but you know, we're speaking tonight, aren't we?
Are we?
Well, it's in my calendar.
Oh, is it? Hell's Teeth? Yes, we're speaking to someone about some stuff. Right, okay.
Yeah. I'll
fax you a memo. Look after yourselves.
You too.
Well done. And mark that 10, I'm going to give you a solid 8.
Oh, fabulous. I'll give you 5.5.
Excellent. Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi.